From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, we go to Northeast Japan, 1 year after its triple disaster, and to Jordan, contending with refugees from strife-torn Syria. We meet fabulously wealthy members of the legislature in the People's Republic of China, and we fly in a decades-old airplane, the DC-3. Last weekend, Japan honored the victims of the earthquake and tsunami that destroyed much of its northeast coast 1 year ago. And Japan's prime minister promised to help rebuild the region. But obstacles exist that go beyond the disaster. Long before last year, the economy of northeast Japan was declining, its population dwindling. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, the region not only needs rebuilding, it may also need rethinking.
With a fierce yell and a resounding thwack, 13-year-old student Nanami Usui brings her bamboo sword down on her opponent. This class in kendo, or Japanese swordsmanship, is helping to rebuild the confidence of Usui and other kids in the town of Minami Sanriku, whose homes were washed away by last year's tsunami. Usui says she dreams of being a police officer, but she doesn't know yet where she wants to live and work.
Most high school students here have dreams about their future careers. I suppose if you want to become a fisherman, you can stay here. But if you want to do anything else, you have to leave this town.
Harsh winds and waves lash Minami Sanriku's sparsely settled coastline. Far from Tokyo's neon-lit cityscapes and Kyoto's serene gardens, this is a part of Japan you seldom hear about. It has an older population, fewer jobs, more suicides, and more tsunamis than the rest of the country. Nobutaka Chiba is a town assemblyman and Usui's kendo teacher. He notes that the last big tsunami in 1960 largely wiped Minami Sanriku off the map.
My father's generation rebuilt this town just the way it was before, but it won't be that way this time. I believe this town has to be reborn.
This time, the government plans to erect a giant seawall to protect the town's commercial area and move residents up into the hills. It'll take a decade to complete. Right now, smashed boats, crumpled cars, and mountains of debris still await removal. Kiyotaka Miura, the local official in charge of planning reconstruction, says things aren't as bad as they look. It may appear to be going slowly, and this may worry some residents, he concedes, but we're definitely making progress with the relocation. It will take time, and we hope residents will be patient. It took the central government 8 months to come up with a reconstruction budget and 11 months to create an agency to administer it. Out of a population of more than 18,000 in Minami Sanriku, the tsunami killed around 1,000, 2,000 were given temporary shelter elsewhere, and another 1,000 just packed up and left for good. Taxi driver Toshie Sasaki, who is living in temporary housing, says his patience is wearing thin.
The temporary housing is only supposed to be for 2 years, and 1 year has already passed. More and more people are leaving this town every day. If they don't speed up the reconstruction, we'll lose our population.
Since the earthquake, architects, economists, and bureaucrats have suggested some futuristic plans for a new northeast coast with high-tech industries, alternative energy power grids, and elevated tsunami-proof coastal towns. But Tsunehide Chino, an assistant professor at Iwate Prefectural University, says these ideas are impractical, and northeasterners should stick to government-subsidized fishing and farming.
What Tokyo and the central government are trying to do is transplant industry to generate income and enrich the Northeast. I think that's the wrong way. Northeasterners should still make their living from natural resources, just as they have been doing.
Chino says that Tokyoites mostly think of the Northeast as a place that gave them tasty salmon, migrant laborers, and cheap electricity from the Fukushima nuclear plant. That is, until three of its reactors melted down after last year's tsunami. It's that kind of attitude that Japan needs to rethink, Chino says, so that Northeasterners get a better economic deal and more recognition. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Tokyo.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says more than 200,000 Syrians have been displaced since the anti-government uprising began 1 year ago. The Syrian regime's brutal crackdown has sent people fleeing the country. Many ended up in Jordan, which has long been a haven for refugees from conflict. NPR's Kelly McEvers recently traveled to Jordan and sent this story about the complications of hospitality.
If you're trying to escape from Syria into Jordan, you have two choices. You can go the legal way, just get in your car and try to drive across the border. But that's not very easy these days. The Syrian government isn't letting many people out. So you can try the illegal way. Wait till nightfall, climb through a barbed wire fence. It sounds sketchy, but if you make it over, you'll actually be welcomed by the Jordanian army. They'll take your name, give you a drink of water, let you rest. After that, though, you're on your own. You might end up in an apartment building that's become a kind of holding pen for hundreds of Syrian refugees. Or you might end up in a place like this, in a town on the Syrian-Jordanian border.
So yeah, we're going in this room now. There's about 20 people staying in one room. It's a pretty run-down building. So a lot of garbage outside and a lot of guys who just got here kind of crowded into this one room.
The men in this room all came from the same village in southern Syria. Their story is eerily similar to the stories of so many cities and towns around Syria. About a month ago, a group of soldiers from their village defected from the Syrian army, refusing to fight for the government. They came back home and started defending their village against security forces, who these men say were arresting and torturing anyone who was thought to oppose the government. A man who only wants to go by the name Abu Ammar says defectors managed to control the village for about 15 days. Then the army stormed it with tanks and mortars, and some of the men fled here. The only assistance the men can get right now is at this private Islamic charity. Recent arrivals crowd around the bearded director. He tells the men he has no cash to help with the rent, but he can provide bags of food. This is the problem for refugees in Jordan. While on the one hand, the country is more open to new arrivals than any other country that borders Syria, the government doesn't have much to offer once they get here. After all, Jordan is already a country of refugees. There are more than 2 million Palestinians in Jordan, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis sought refuge in Jordan after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Jordan allows these guests, as it calls them, to go to government schools and hospitals for free, but it doesn't have unlimited resources. That's why, says Andrew Harper, who heads the Jordan office for the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees, the U.S. and other countries that say they're committed to helping Syrians who oppose their government need to make good on that promise and pony up. And that doesn't just mean cash for the Syrians themselves, he says, but also for the Jordanians who are hosting them.
Jordan can only do so much. Jordan suffers from a lack of infrastructure. It's got a very young population. It doesn't have very much water. I spoke to some Jordanians who basically had their own family, but they also had two other families there. And they're saying, well, we're doing what we need to do because we should do this, but there's only so long which we can do this for.
Jordanian analyst Yassar Katarne says regardless of whether it gets international assistance, Jordan has to walk a fine line with its stance on Syria. For one, no one's sure which way Syria will go, whether the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will fall or not. And even if it does fall, Katarne says Jordan's rulers don't want to see their neighbor be ruled by Islamist parties like the Muslim Brotherhood.
We cannot remain silent to what our brothers in Syria are facing from the Assad regime. Yet at the same time, we don't want to replace Assad regime to have just another puppet regime in the hands of the Muslim Brothers.
Jordan has its own nonviolent but outspoken branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. While the Syrian opposition is not currently dominated by such Islamist parties, Katarne says Jordan, like all countries with interests in what happens in Syria, is planning for all possibilities. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
In China, the annual legislative session is underway. This year, it's been mockingly called Beijing Fashion Week, as a criticism of the delegates' luxury-branded clothes. As the tales of excess grip China's internet, NPR's Louisa Lim examines whether China's legislative body is in danger of becoming a rich man's club.
A leather belt from Hermes costing almost $1,000, nearly a year's salary for the average Chinese farmer. A $2,000 bright pink trouser suit from Emilio Pucci. A red snakeskin Celine handbag costing $4,500. One eagle-eyed photo editor spotted delegates to China's Legislative Assembly wearing these costly accessories. It's the perfect illustration of China's yawning wealth gap. So she posted the pictures online, and they went viral. The editor, who asked that her name not be disclosed, told NPR why she'd taken this step.
China doesn't really have a transparent and just system of supervision, such as publicizing officials' wealth. The most obvious and effective way of doing this is seeing what they're wearing, especially luxury items, which are not necessities.
The truth is that delegates to the National People's Congress, or NPC, include some of the richest people in the country. It stems from the decision 10 years ago to allow capitalists into the Communist Party.
We did a report the other day which showed that the top 70 NPC delegates are probably richer than the entire US Congress, which is rather ironic considering that China's a developing country and the US is the most developed country in the world.
That's Rupert Hoogeworth, who draws up the Hurun list of the 1,000 richest Chinese. In fact, the wealthiest 70 delegates are worth $89 billion. According to Bloomberg News, that's 11 times the net worth of the entire US Congress, plus the president, his cabinet, and the Supreme Court. So how did this happen? Rupert Hoogeworth again.
It's very much a chicken and egg scenario. I mean, is it because they're rich that they become powerful, or is it because they're powerful that they become rich? The general consensus is that it tends to be that they've been successful individuals in their business world, and that therefore they've been co-opted into the top political advisory boards.
The corridors of the Great Hall of the People throb with a heady mix of power and wealth. Hoogeworth's research found 152 of the richest 1,000 Chinese hold political office. Their wealth amounts to 44% of the rich list wealth. All this adds to the criticism that the NPC has become a rich man's club. Denying that is National People's Congress delegate Cao Zhaoyang from Aulus, a company that makes car tires.
My company has 3,000 workers, and I have dealings with them every day, so I need to know what they're thinking. I also need to know what the bosses think and what the state thinks. So we as a class have our advantages, but it's an exaggeration to call it a rich man's club.
One wonders what Chairman Mao would have made of all this. He also founded the advisory body, the CPPCC. This is their song, recorded 2 years ago by famous delegates. And the CPPCC is even more wealthy than the legislative body. Huang Xiaoliang is a real estate tycoon and the 797th richest person in China. He defends his right to be a delegate.
I don't think it's true that the body doesn't represent disadvantaged groups. It's the opposite. It's more representative. We dare to speak more and speak the truth.
But netizens don't agree. This satirical song mocks the powerful and wealthy delegates for singing happy songs and suggesting proposals that don't go anywhere. For all the power and wealth co-opted into China's congresses, it's a common belief they're simply rubber stamps for government policy. Or, as the song's lyrics have it, the wealthy delegates sing songs of praise and lie about the future. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, a lesson on Cockney rhyming slang and a flight on board the World War II warhorse, the DC-3. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Ted Clark. In Britain, everyone is eagerly looking forward to the opening of the Summer Olympics. NPR's London-based correspondent Philip Reeves sends us an occasional letter about the Games. His latest contains a warning for those of you planning to go to the Olympics. Phil says if you think you'll get around London easily just because you speak English, think again.
Americans and Britons enjoy sharing a mother tongue. I mean, we understand one another pretty well, don't we? Well, no, not always. English spoken by the British has some bizarre variants. One of the weirdest of these is found in the kingdom's capital. The Olympic Games will be based here, in East London, in one of the city's poorest parts. This isn't much like the London of Big Ben and Buckingham Palace. It's a drab, flat sprawl north of the River Thames. If you're planning to come, prepare to be baffled. People around here speak in code. Listen for a minute to EastEnders Nicola McCluskey and Jackie Dunning.
Apples and pears is stairs. Mince pies is eyes.
Daisy ropes is your boats.
Yeah.
The Olympics are being held in the heartland of Cockney rhyming slang. This odd linguistic device was introduced in Victorian times by Cockney market traders who wanted to avoid being overheard by the police. The Cockneys used to be working-class Londoners from the East End. Many have moved out of town and up the social ladder. These days in East London you hear a vast range of languages, from Urdu to Polish. Yet Cockney rhyming slang continues to thrive.
People use it every day. I mean, we use it, we don't even know we're using it, do we? You know, you say something and it's just part of what we say. It's like our everyday speech, sort of feel like. I say to the girls, I'll just quickly run up the apples and pears.
My husband sat and taught my son Cockney rhyming slang right from being little, because it's important, yeah.
I've got loads of examples. Parts of the body, for example.
Gordon Smith collects Cockney rhyming slang for fun and puts it on his website, cockneyrhymingslang.co.uk.
Starting from the top, you've got your Barnet Fair, that's your hair. You've got your boat race, that's your face. You've got your I suppose, that's your nose. Mince pies, north and south.
Gregory Peck, what is that?
Well, that's your neck.
You see how it works, right? You take a word, let's say talk, replace it with a rhyming phrase, rabbit and pork, and drop the rhyming word. Thus, the word for talking too much in Cockney becomes a small furry animal. Four and a half months remain before the start of the Olympics. The verbal gymnastics have already begun. London's bloggers, including Smith, are busy compiling rhyming slang specially for the Games.
We've got the cycling, and the word bike is Dick Van Dyke in Cockney rhyming slang. Tennis players will be using balls, so that's Albert Halls. And these are all genuine Cockney expressions.
There's a rumour the rhyming slang for the Games themselves is the Sids, after the late Sid James. You may not have heard of him, but he was a big comedy star in Britain, thanks largely to the Carry On movies. EastEnders Nicola McCluskey and Jackie Dunning don't think the Sids will catch on.
I've not heard that one. No, see, there's a lot of new slang brought out by people, and like some of it you have to say to them, what does that mean? Because it's not the true slang,
like,
is it?
What we were taught when we were younger.
It's fake.
Yeah.
We won't have it. We want the true ones.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
A Douglas DC-3 hangs in the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum in Washington, a relic of a bygone era. DC-3s transported GIs during World War II, but the planes are not relics in Colombia's Amazon. They're known as buses of the jungle, and they serve as the only link to places barely touched by modernity. NPR's Juan Ferrero flew on a DC-3 to Caruru, Colombia.
The DC-3, flown by Captain Ricardo Fajardo, has been flying for nearly 70 years. But as Flight 1149 hugs the treetops and skims past the Valpes River, Captain Fajardo says he wouldn't feel more comfortable in any other plane. Nose slightly up, he puts the aircraft down softly on a slippery dirt runway. The DC-3 comes to a fast stop in the middle of Colombia's Amazonian jungle.
Bueno, pues.
Karuru.
Okay, Karuru, we're here, Captain Fajardo says. Karuru, 100 miles west of the Brazilian border in southeastern Colombia, has no roads linking it to the outside world. And its 800 residents know that going by river to a sizable town would take days.
No hay nada, el avión es todo.
Here there's nothing, says Fajardo, a pilot for 44 years. The plane is everything. In this sparsely populated swath of plains and jungle the size of France, the runways are muddy and the cargo is heavy. The only plane that handles the job must be lumbering, with big balloon wheels and the durability to take a pounding. Hans Weissman, a Dutchman who searched out DC-3s the world over for a documentary film and his book, says it's a region tailor-made for the DC-3. That's why he says the 10 or so planes flying here will likely continue to operate for years to come.
The DC-3 flies in low and slow in places where no jet, truck or boat can go. That is exactly the survival law for the DC-3.
On a recent day, Fajardo's DC-3, one of four in the Sedelka Airlines fleet, is loaded up with gasoline, fruits and vegetables, a widescreen TV, and boxes of newly hatched chicks. With cargo at their feet, about a dozen passengers sit with their backs to the fuselage, just like the American paratroopers who were transported in the same planes during World War II. Flight 1149 may have a GPS and radar, but there's no automatic pilot or fancy avionics or pressurized cabin. The plane flies as low as 4,000 feet from one hamlet to another at a speed of about 130 miles per hour. Co-pilot Victor Valencia says it's a different flying experience.
Es otro tipo de aviación. Es aviación, aviación, diríamos, aviación real.
It's another kind of aviation, real aviation, as you can see, Valencia says. What he means is someone's hands are on the controls at all times. The pilots also keep careful track of landmarks, the curve of a river here, the thatched roofs of an Indian village over there. And vital to the success of each flight is mechanic John Ruhana, who's in the cockpit making sure nothing goes wrong as the plane prepares to touch down. He yanks the yellow lever that lowers the flaps and the red one that puts down the landing gear. As the plane cools down in another stop on its milk run, Ruhana, wrench in hand, checks the engines, the landing gear, the oil. And pretty soon, the DC-3 is loaded up and ready to go on its way to another town in the Colombian jungle. Juan Ferrero, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.